So what time is it where you are?
It's 5 o'clock here. I'm based in Berlin in Germany, but I'm originally from Australia, so that's why the accent is more in the Australian direction than in the German direction.
Nice. How long have you been in Berlin?
Like 4 years now, I think. It's gone actually, yeah, 4 years and a week. It's gone super fast, and it's home now. But that is not like, if you had asked me 5 years ago, where do you think your life will be in 4 years? I probably wouldn't have said it here.
Yeah, I can imagine exactly. When I moved to Chicago, I thought I'd be here 3 months, and that was in 2014.
Right, and you're still there
Yeah.
today.
Yeah.
It's
And
great.
the longer you're in a place, the harder it would be to leave, because you got your friends, you got your job, you got your activities.
Right, and like once you've moved country or like even city or even state, I think like once, then moving back is like, it's not moving home anymore after a while. It's moving again, like if I went back to Sydney now, I'd have to like rebuild all of those social networks and stuff. And it's a complicated equation.
Yeah, I run into that. My mom is located in, I'm getting to an age where I'm starting to think about, I'm at the age where people tend to move to be closer to family, basically. And I'm thinking about, like, where is my family? Well, my dad's whole family is in rural Louisiana, so I don't know how I would be a programmer there, so I'm not going there. Which leaves basically my mom is in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and my aunt is in Manhattan. And it's like, well, so Chattanooga would potentially be like, I'm closer to my mom than I am to my aunt. But the thing is, Chattanooga, it's like not a particularly progressive place. It's where I went to high school, but just like you're saying, it's not the same as moving home because, like, I don't know anyone there now, It would not, it would be moving again. And like, my mom would be close by, but that.
It's kind of complicated, and I think this is something that a lot of I don't know, I get the impression that people in the US move around a lot more than like on a city level than Australians do. Like we've only got four or five like really, really large cities. So if you're moving to a city for work, then probably like there's a pretty high chance that it'll be the one that you're already in, for a lot of people.
That makes sense.
What do you actually, so what I know of you from the internet, but I don't actually know like what you do or anything like that. Like I know you from
I made
Twitter
a fool of
basically,
myself on the internet.
and I think you're an educator, but that's about as far as my knowledge goes.
So I'm a software engineer, and by day I have a software consultancy, so I work with clients, and typically it's clients who are doing something to address the climate crisis or advancing basic scientific research or providing resources for underserved communities. So examples of projects that I work on right now, I'm working on a dual platform mobile application that helps space science and earth science researchers crowdsource image analysis. And yeah, it's super cool. And then another project for that same client, basically doing automated processing of NASA Landsat satellite data so that earth science researchers can use it more easily. And then I have a client who I'm working on an Android app for them, and they do it's a clinic in Pennsylvania that specializes in cancer recovery research. And so it's to help people who are in chemo who are recovering from cancer. And then this is the like funny exception. I'm working on an iOS app for a company called Braden Press. They're out of Canada. And the woman who runs Braden Press, she is a linguist. She studies linguistics and particularly kind of the effect of how language changes, and particularly like languages that are kind of dying out. And so she wrote this book. It's called the Scottish Gaelic Tattoo Handbook, and it was just about how to translate English and Gaelic phrases for people who want to put on Scottish Gaelic tattoos. And it blew up. It was super popular. And so she wanted to make an iOS app that helps people translate between English and Scottish Gaelic phrases. So she approached me with the app like idea. And so I'm working on the app, but that one's really fun because I do a fair amount of live streaming of my work. Particularly open source applications that I work on, I live stream a lot. And this app, I decided at the beginning, I'm going to live stream every line of code that I write on this app.
Cool.
And it starts with stream one, like open Xcode. And now we're on stream 12 and we have like an app that does something, and it's, I don't know, it's cool. So
that's like that process right at the start of mobile development is like the whole like open Xcode, make sure like create a bunch of new files. Is that once like that thing that you do once every few months that is like super rusty and slow to start. And then that momentum after like the third or fourth session of, that's a really nice feeling once the ball is rolling there.
Yeah, it's been super fun. The other thing about it is that, like I do mobile development, but my background, I've just done more back end than front end in my career.
Yeah.
And so when we get to the part where I'm writing Swift and I'm testing Swift, like that's one thing, but storyboarding is very different. And I also happen to believe personally that it's not just my inexperience. It's also that storyboard is not a particularly intuitive tool in my opinion.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, what I did was I had a million mockups for this app before I started. So I opened Xcode, and what I decided to do was like, all right, before I start writing any code, I'm going to try to like do a skeletal assimilation of the way that the mockups kind of look, because that'll demonstrate progress to the, you know, if the client is like not a programmer themselves, then it's like, it's help. They see progress and they enjoy being able to see screens. So I was like, I'm going to start with some screens. And the first few streams are just like me building screens in Xcode. And there's basically two and a half streams like figuring out how to get an existing composite view embedded in a scroll view.
Right. Yeah.
Why was that so hard? You know?
I can't tell if this is a UI programming thing or if this is like specifically a Swift thing. I think like Android, so my background is I spent the first like half of my career as an Android developer, and then the last 4 years I've been doing backend stuff.
Oh, nice.
And Android has completely changed since then. Like was at an Android conference 2 years ago and had no idea what was going on. It was extremely humbling because I thought I was pretty good at it at some point in time, and then the whole ecosystem had moved.
Now the language is different. They came out with constraint layout. Everything's different.
Yeah, it's changed a lot. And I think like for the better, and it's also really good to see Google putting an emphasis on like usability of APIs on Android, because that was definitely not, like, I didn't see that reflected in the way that like a lot of the APIs were developed right at the start. There's a lot of stuff that felt like a little bit rushed, or like, I mean, I guess the operating system was kind of rushed. It was built pretty quickly after the iPhone launched. But yeah, it's cool to see like this kind of coming together and becoming more polished and more accessible and more easy to build for, as time goes on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's super cool. What, did you make a conscious choice to go from Android to backend, or did it just kind of happen?
No, it was completely by accident. So you know how sometimes you see job descriptions that, are hiring full stack developers. I feel like it always starts like this. Like a full stack developer can mean basically anything. In my case, I was kind of hired to be an Android developer and then like branch out to do a little bit of Python backend stuff. When there was downtime, it was like a pretty small company at that point. And then 4 years later, I discovered that I'd been spending most of my time doing the Python stuff and then moving more and more in the infrastructure direction as well. Mm-hmm. So I think nowadays I'd probably call myself more of a backend developer, but I guess like the thing is, I think there are skills that like front end and backend are very different in that the skills that you need, like all the ancillary skills are different. The programming stuff is the same, but like for front end, for like the very front of front end, you need some actual design skills a little bit, because like you need to be able to communicate with the designers. You need to be able to like sometimes just adjust things slightly to make it work and know how that works. And then like at the very back end of back end, there's like hard database stuff. And there's all this space in between. So, I've now got like a weird mix of skills that kind of fit the whole way along the spectrum, and it is what it is. So yeah, I don't know. I guess like the jobs I'm looking for at the moment are more back-end oriented, but that's more just because that's the trajectory I'm on. It's not necessarily like an intentional thing. Yeah.
Makes sense. Yeah. Are you looking for specific kinds of companies or anything?
Yeah, that's a good question. I started my search for jobs looking for things that were for companies that were working on things that were really, really meaningful. Mm-hmm. And also companies that had at least I think I was thinking like at least 30% women on the engineering team as like a minimum, or at least 30% not men. Mm-hmm. And as time has gone on, like realizing that there's a handful of companies that are doing this right. Mm-hmm. In Berlin, it's even harder somehow. And so this is kind of the constraints. So that was like definitely a criteria at the start. Working on something that's actually useful is still a big thing. The last company I was working for does remittances to Africa specifically. So like focusing on, it used to cost, I think about 10% on was the average cost of remittances to Africa from the US. And like, that's completely unacceptable.
Yeah. That's so and, high.
Right. It's enormous. Yeah. And so this company was trying to make that easier and cheaper and succeeding. They're a pretty good company. They're quite small in terms of engineering, but like they do a good job of what they do. And so they were called Sendwave, and I kind of wanted to carry on working on stuff that was like basically not advertising, not blockchain.
Right.
stuff that's making the world a better place. Indie publishing is really interesting, stuff that like promotes marginalized voices.
Yeah.
Environmental stuff. Stuff that reduces the cost of like ordinary things as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's super cool.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah.
You found it. Like has quarantine and the subsequent move to remote work for companies made it, has that broadened your, like the companies that you can look at as candidates because they're not requiring you to be in the same city or move or come in?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure. I think the biggest discrepancy is that a lot of the, like as someone English speaking and as someone who's worked for American companies for basically my entire career, like a lot of my bubble is English speaking American companies.
Mm-hmm.
But then they also need to be able to officially employ people in Germany to comply with like my visa and my like living All right. situation and stuff like that. So I can't just like, it's not quite as simple as just like work for a foreign company. What is changing is that some of these larger some of the larger multinationals are now looking at other parts of like are now kind of adjusting their remote strategies, and I think looking at parts of Europe that they're not necessarily in yet, like other countries, and saying like, well, maybe we can set HR up here, maybe it's not so hard, and that kind of increases the range of options a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think if I was a freelancer, that would probably be different. There'd probably be like more opportunities for work from different places, but I don't think I have the confidence to do freelance work at the moment. I'm not sure.
It's certainly a different kind of, it's a different breakdown of what you're working on day to day. And there are a couple of, like the skill set's a little bit different for sure.
Have you been working freelance for your whole career?
I haven't. I worked for a company called Pivotal Labs for a long time.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And then I worked for another company here called Ascent Technologies. And then at that point, I was like pretty burnt out for a couple different reasons. And I thought, well, either I'm going to take some time off or like I have to change something. And so, but I knew that like, even if I don't take time off, I either need to take time off or I need to find something that's going to allow me to work less than 5 days per week because I need to recover.
Yep.
And so I called up actually an organization that I had volunteered, that I had done some volunteer work with a couple of years prior, that I had always really admired, that is purely grant funded. And I said, I know you're purely grant funded, and so you might not, this might not work for you, but like if I'm planning on taking time off anyway, but if there's something that we can arrange, then I'm available. And I felt like I would be remiss not to tell you because I would love to be able to help y'all or work for y'all in some capacity. And the VP there got back to me, who runs the team, and she said, well, our mobile developer handed in his notice about 2 hours ago. So it would be good if we could talk. And I struck an arrangement with them where I was working with them like 20 to 24 hours a week for a little while I got my legs back under me a little bit.
Yeah.
And they've just like stayed a client, and it's been a really great sort of relationship. And I had 3 to 4 days a week to recover and learn some things on my own that I had been putting off learning because I just didn't have the time and frankly the energy. I think that a lot of times for me, time isn't even the limiting factor. Like the reason I run out of time is because I was futzing around, and the reason I was futzing around was because I ran out of energy.
Right, yeah, this is a super relevant problem in our industry, I think, because we focus, like, the work we do is really focused and really intensive. And so, yeah, I think, like, especially in my last job, I was working remotely and on a time zone that was 6 hours different from, like, most of my colleagues. So I had some really, really focused time in the morning. But after, like, 6 hours, it's really hard to keep concentrating. And I don't know how companies expect, like, especially because the whole thing about tech companies in the Silicon Valley sometimes as well, like expecting people to work 60, 70 hours a week. Like, I am not that much more effective after 30.
No.
I mean, I don't,
If I write code after 5:30 p.m., about, I'm just going to break everything. And, like, if I'm lucky, I'll get it fixed to the point that it's back where it was when I started by the next morning. But probably I'll spend the next morning unmessing up whatever I messed up yesterday evening.
I found sometimes I can work late, but then what ends up happening is the next, like, some days I've managed to work like 9 hours of like solid focus programming in a day, but then the next day I've only got the energy for like five or
Right.
four. And so I'm like, yeah, it's I can't, yeah, I don't know. I can't, like, I can't tell if it's a me thing or if it's just that the work is actually hard and we're not really talking about it as much as we should be. I suspect it could even be a combination of both, you know, like,
Yeah.
But yeah, it's
Do you find that you have an easier time programming at like specific times, like the morning or the afternoon?
I don't honestly. So in my last job, I had a system going where I would basically program from 8:30 to like 12:30, and then take a few hours off for lunch, and then sign back on from 3 till 6 to do meetings, and that was like that was great, but I think like the most important factors for me personally are just having a like controlled, focused environment that minimizes distractions. I was way more flexible about this like early on, like even 4 years ago, I could work from cafes and stuff, but now I'm like, I need a like external monitor and a keyboard and stuff. And it's interesting how it's changed. I've gotten less flexible over time. But yeah, that's more of a thing for me. Do you have like times that work better for you or?
Similarly, I like to program in the morning. I like to get something done in the morning because that kind of like puts me on a roll that I can kind of continue. I like to do, my ideal situation would be to program for several hours in the morning and then do meetings in the afternoon. Most of my clients happen to have their meetings in the morning, and so that, like, you know, it is what it is. But I also have this like weird time in the evening where I can work on code happily as long as it's not serious. Like as long as it's not code that like there's actually consequences if I break it.
So
So
like more, so not anything that's like crazy hard algorithms, but stuff that is like kind of easier to put together, or is it about the pressure of the importance of the code?
I think it's about the pressure. Like lately, I've been working on, back in December, I took this class on the Raft distributed consensus algorithm and we started implementing it. And I didn't finish in a week, but I kept working on it after that and was like blogging my progress. And then the spring semester started. And this spring, I was teaching a course of my own design for the first time. I had taught other people's courses before. Yeah. But it was so much work. It was like 30 hours a week of work. And I was like, I can't keep doing this Raft thing and teaching this class and designing this class. Because it was 30 hours a week of design and implementation outside of actual teaching and outside of office hours. And I was like, this is too much.
It's
With
way
all
too
the other
much.
clients, like, I was like, no. So I finished that much. We're now in the second run of the class. And this time, it is less work. There's still a lot of iteration happening because I learned a whole bunch from the first run. But a lot of the videos, like a lot of the work really is done. And so I've had the opportunity to kind of take on another thing again, whereas I didn't before, and I decided, you know what, I'd really like to go back to implementing Raft. I would like to get that. I would like to finish it.
Okay.
And so I've been working on that, and it's like, it's definitely hard from like an intellectual algorithm design type of perspective, but because it doesn't really matter when I finish, and it doesn't really matter if I break it, and I've already accepted that it's like not particularly clean code, because the point isn't to write clean code. The point is to learn about Raft.
Mm-hmm.
I can just be like, you know, last night I was working on it. I think I tweeted about this. You may have already seen this, but there was a situation. There was a problem I was trying to solve, and I couldn't figure out a good design, like a good data design. Mm-hmm. And so in the meantime, I'm storing the same data twice in a dictionary that's quick to index off of, and an array, because I need the numerical index. And so I have a class now that holds it holds an array called the worst array and a dictionary
called only
marginally better.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, I'll figure it out later. Right now,
that's the best kind of programming. Like, I mean, I left my job in December last year and then spent 3 months at the Ricoh Center in New York, which is like, it's like a community, it's like an educational community. So basically the idea is you go there to get better at programming by working on your own projects.
Right.
But there's like 50 people all doing that together. And so if you get stuck, you can just say like, hey, can you help me? Does anyone know Python? Or like, does anyone know like the Raft consensus algorithm or like stuff like that? And so it's a really supportive community for working on things like that. And I wrote a bunch of code to like render images from digital cameras, like from the raw stuff that comes out of the camera sensor into like an actual JPEG image, which is like ludicrously complicated, but I could write the messiest, most horrible code and just like ignore the tests.
Right.
It was so satisfying. It's like, it's that feeling of like, oh, this is why I got into programming in the first place. And it's just a different. Yeah, I don't know. I read something the other day that said just because you like the difference between software engineering as a profession and programming is like programming is the thing. It can be a hobby. Software engineering is the job. They're like,
right,
kind of, yeah, in the same way that like just because you like woodwork doesn't mean you should become a woodworker, or just because you make your own sourdough, it doesn't mean you should become a baker.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's something nice about, I really like that analogy, because it's like, suppose I were a professional chef. That's a completely different thing. And it takes all this energy, and it could be so refreshing just to go in my kitchen and be like, I'm going to make a loaf of bread. And it could come out terrible. And I could ignore every single process that I have to follow in a commercial kitchen. And it's fine. That's quite literally what it is. In my job, I'm working in a commercial kitchen. Things need to be clean. Things need to be hygienic. I need to be able to communicate with other chefs. At home, make a giant mess all over the floor. Whatever. Yep. Everybody can, like, people come in the kitchen and they don't know what the heck is going on. It's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. It's liberating.
There's something so nice about it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
But
definitely.
Yeah. It's been really fun. And it exactly like you were saying, it's been, oh, this is why I do this. It's like frustrating in the most satisfying way.
Yeah.
Like, I'm so angry at my computer right now, and I'm having so much fun.
Yeah, that's not a combination that, like, normally it's the other way around. Normally for me, I'm like angry at my computer, and then I'm like, why did I get into this crazy, I initially didn't study computer science because I thought the computers were too frustrating. It would drive me crazy, and then somehow fell back into it, you know? So I think I find myself coming back to it despite the, like, that constant sense of frustration. But I think when you figure something out, that like that feeling of like oh, now it all makes sense, now I understand that the computer was confused because I was telling it to do something that wasn't quite exactly what I should have been saying. And
it's super interesting, but I don't know, it's been so, yeah, there's that. Anyway, yeah, so I write code by day, and then by night I teach, and it's been fun. It's been a lot, particularly during quarantine, because it's like everything is now from my house. I'm interested to know how you've kind of solved that, because in my house there's like an area that's my classroom and an area that's my work and an area that's my gym, and like I live in a glorified studio one bedroom hybrid kind of thing.
Yep.
Like, it's not designed to be somebody's whole life, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. This hasn't been like quite so bad for me. I think mostly because I am still unemployed. Like, I mean, I'm not stuck at my desk all day. But yeah, like, I don't know. I have the same thing. Like, you can see my bed in the back of the frame right there. Like, this is I'm in a share flat. I have like a few housemates, and like my kind of the space I'm in the most is probably this, but I think I've been staying sane by just spending time outside as much as possible, outside of computer based pursuits. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of worked pretty effectively. There's a lot of green space here, so it's very easy. Yeah.
That's really nice.
Yeah.
We don't have a good city for that. Chicago is harder. And we only get like, I would say 3 nice months a year. That's not entirely true. We get like about 4.5 months of really nice weather.
Yeah.
Or at least like nice enough that going outside isn't terrible. Weather.
Like not too cold or not too hot or kind of like somewhere in between or.
Yeah. It gets so cold here and like very, and winter in Chicago lasts forever. It lasts right until halfway through June. And so it's just.
That's late. Yeah. Yeah. You're a long way north there, I guess.
Yeah. We're pretty far north. And, in, you know, as the climate changes, we get more like gusts from even further north, and so it's been a situation. Funny, in January we had this like polar vortex situation.
Yeah, that's right. I heard about that.
Negative 46 degrees with wind chill in Chicago.
That's in Fahrenheit, right?
Yeah. What would that be?
I don't know. My brain goes down to about like my brain doesn't go that low.
It's super cold. It's people are not supposed to be survive that cold. People were posting pictures on Instagram.
It's the same temperature in Celsius. It's so cold that it just like doesn't matter.
Oh my God.
Yikes.
It was. But yeah, people had pictures on their Instagram of like the lock on their door having ice crystals on it on the inside.
Yikes. Oh,
and it was goodness. Absolutely absurd. And it just so happened, I wasn't in Chicago that week. I happened to be in New York that week. And I will never forget this because my aunt, it got down to 1 degree Fahrenheit,
mm-hmm.
and which is still below freezing, but that's like
insanely cold. Yeah.
My aunt was like, "Oh, I'm so sorry. It's so cold. Like, really, like you should come when the weather is nicer. Now is not a good time to be in New York." And I said to her, "Like, do you know where I came from? This is. I would much rather be here than where I would have been if I weren't here."
Oh yeah. Yeah.
But, man. Yeah, it was. And then a couple days later, it got up to 13 degrees Fahrenheit, which, once like again.
Practically summer by that point.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. A couple days later, 39 degrees above freezing, even. Yeah,
crazy. Crazy.
Like, that's. Yeah. 39 degrees is comfortable if you're from Chicago.
It's amazing to. Like, so I come from Australia. It's mm-hmm. really warm there all the time. I think it's the middle of winter there at the moment, maybe like starting to come out of winter now. And I think like on the coast where my family is, it's maybe like, oh gosh, I'm trying to do some maths in my head and I don't know if it's working. I think it's like 60 or 70 Fahrenheit. Like,
oh, wow.
14 degrees Celsius is like as cold as it gets. Maybe sometimes like some places, if you go inland enough, it'll get down to like 30 Fahrenheit.
13. But it's Celsius in Fahrenheit, 55. That's so nice.
Yeah, it's pretty comfortable. And so coming to Berlin, everyone like warns me about the winter, but honestly it's not a problem because there's heating everywhere. But then when it gets hot here in the summer, then everyone melts because the houses are built to keep the heat in because of the winters. So it's I don't know, climate change is going to be real interesting for a whole lot of architects, I think, and city planners.
Oh my goodness.
Yep.
Oh, what a situation we're in.
What a situation. It just keeps getting more intense.
Yeah.
I can't believe it. Just everything, like just when you think it's finished escalating, it's just one.
You know what somebody said to me? I think Imani Barberin on Twitter, she said 2020 is like if forever, every good luck thing that ever happened, everyone was just waiting for the other shoe to drop. And 2020 is just the year all the shoes were scheduled to drop.
Right.
And now 2020 is like the season finale of humans on Earth.
Yeah. If we make it through it, then I think we're into some good karma for a little while now that we've paid down all the bad.
It's like, oh my gosh, what a mess it is.
Insane.
Well, the United States continues to refuse paying it down, right? So we're not allowed to leave. Now, our passports are worthless. Worthless. And our whole lives we were told, like, your passport is great. You can go anywhere. Like, people want an American passport. I could, even if I wanted to, I couldn't sell my passport on the black market for a dime now.
Yeah, it's definitely changed the perception of a lot of things, I think. It's kind of, yeah, I don't know. Coronavirus has just made everything ludicrously complicated. Like, I think it's relatively, things here in the EU are a little more, you can still move around and stuff. But, like, if you're an Australian citizen, you're not allowed to leave as well, unless, like, you're a permanent resident of another, like, unless you're a resident of another country and you can prove that. Mm-hmm. Is that car noise coming from my side or yours?
I think it's from your side. Is there, what's happening down there? Is there a protest?
I don't know. If there was a protest, you'd know there would be bass. I live on a super busy street. Oh my goodness. It's so noisy. There's nothing. It's just, yeah. I gave a talk at a remote conference a couple months ago, and I have the train runs like past my window as well. You can make eye contact with the commuters. It's terrifying.
Oh my god. But
my parents were watching this conference talk that I'd recorded, and they were like, I could hear, oh, maybe you can hear it now. But they were like, I could hear the train going past in the background while you were speaking. Goodness. I didn't think anyone else knew what it was, but it's just like, it's just a fact of life here.
Oh my gosh.
It's just, you know, yeah. Take the good with the bad. Noisy street. Should we talk about blogging as well?
We talk about blogging.
Yeah.
I'm glad we got time to get to know each other,
though. Yeah, me too. I was like, I have no idea what exactly this is going to. I was like, I've never done anything like this before. I don't know exactly what it's going to look like. But it's nice to actually meet you.
Me either.
To meet someone that you know from the internet. It's like, oh, cool.
We're real people.
Turns out,
real humans. Sometimes, not always. Sometimes. don't let me get ahead of myself. We're not all real people. Some of us are real people for sure, but. Blogging. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts on your writing process. I definitely have thoughts about my writing process, but one thing I wanted to mention was that you had sent over a, let me pull it up real quick, because you had sent over some resources that you have used for your writing.
Yes.
And there was one that I had never seen before, but I went ahead and looked at it. It's RobertHeaton.com, RobertHeaton.com, and he talks about his writing style. And honestly, when I read that, I thought, I don't need to write this out for people. I'll just send people this.
Yeah.
This is how I do it. And I never realized, everything that he was saying, I was like, yeah, I do that. Because he starts with how you pick topics and says that he picks evergreen top. Well, not evergreen. He says he wants a blog post topic that's going to still be relevant at least 5 years from now, rather than talking about the latest version of whatever software. And I do exactly that thing, particularly with talk in blogs as well, but with talks too. I try to pick stuff with a shelf life. And then he says that he picks a topic and an angle. So what's he going to talk about? And then what perspective is he going to talk? Is he going to apply to that topic? And I do exactly that thing. Reading it, I was like, this is it. This is what I do. So I'm interested to hear how you found that, what you got from it, all that stuff.
Yeah, so I stumbled across this when I was writing a talk proposal. The thing that really, really stuck with me is this idea that Robert talks about the made-up award principle. So the idea is that every time you write something, it doesn't have to be the best like you make this award that you're making up like really, really, really specific. So like rather than having like the best article about React.js, have the best article about using React.js to like quickly put up photos of cats on the internet or something like that. And by making the thing specific, like making your award specific as possible and then writing the best one of those really specific things, I think you give like a really interesting like voice and character to your work. And so that's kind of something that I tried to do like when I got really lost with a couple of like really, really, really technical blog posts that could have been like these enormous projects that like there was a lot of content that could have gone into this, but that kind of helped me find like a focus. You know, it kind of helps you clarify exactly like what's important in the work and what's not, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's an interesting one. And I think especially applicable to technical writing, because it's really easy to accidentally make people's eyes glaze over with technical writing, because if you're sharing like a million code samples, or if you share like an 80 line code sample, people, they're like, what am I supposed to make of this? You know, it's hard. And so even if you're trying to share like how you would do the full implementation of something, like if it's a long code sample, people aren't going to read it. They're either going to skip it or they're going to copy pasta it for some, you know.
Thing. Yeah. Yeah. I think even for like short code samples, you kind of run the risk of that as well. And it's probably useful to have it there as a reference, but like just like keeping it small and then like talking about the specific things that are like important in that specific, like explicitly in the text as well, is maybe not a bad, I think that's something that I've done before.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that helps a lot. It's interesting with code samples. There's also, so Hillel Wayne is another software educator here in Chicago, and he wrote a blog post about examples, a couple blog posts about examples, and the reasons why you would use specific examples. And he points out that how engaging a piece of software writing is has a lot to do with how appropriate the examples are, what type of examples are used. And he points out some different types. Like there are illustrative examples that are designed to show like what you're talking about. There are instructive examples that are supposed to show you how to do something specific. And there are persuasive examples that are supposed to persuade you as to why to do specific things. And a lot of times in books and pieces, it's just like the wrong type of example. Like the piece is designed to persuade somebody to use a specific type of testing, and then the example is just like, this is what a test looks like, even though the audience is people who are already familiar with testing and you're trying to like persuade them to do this particular type of testing.
I think that's a really interesting point, and one that I hadn't actually thought about like that before. I think what's actually really interesting about this as a category is there's a whole bunch of stuff that people do like subconsciously and implicitly without like, and then that kind of doesn't ever get made explicit until someone like points that out to you, if that makes sense. Like you were saying before that you do exactly this stuff that's in this Robert Heaton article, and you had never like, and you're like, oh, I didn't need to write this down anymore because here it is. This like different kinds of examples thing touches on the idea that there are different kinds of blog posts as well. And I'm kind of curious, like this is something that I've thought about a little bit, because like sometimes I write like very short form things that are like, just like, here are like three things that I learned about something. And then sometimes I write like longer essays that are like, here is this complicated explanation of how something extremely nuanced works for like a very, very, very targeted audience. Mm-hmm. But like, I'm sure there's like plenty of other things outside of like those two binaries that I kind of tend to stick with. What are the like categories that you like, what are the kind of categories of blog posts that you tend to write?
This is a good question, because I think that the answer to this has changed over time. And that's because the reason that I write has changed over time. Because when I first started my blog, I did it because I wanted to document that I knew things for like potential employers. And so I would write like, look, I read this book. Here's what I thought of it. Look, I wrote this code. This is what it was like to write it, just to demonstrate I had written code and I had read books. That was the point. And that was in the very beginning, you know, and I look back on those pieces and I realize they're like fine, but the voice that I have now wasn't necessarily there. And once I got into professional software engineering, one of the things I was running into was like, well, now I know a few things, but I'm having a lot of trouble getting people to listen to me and I get interrupted all the time. And so in that respect, the blog became a place of solace for me where I knew that I could write out what I was thinking and I could take as long as I wanted. And nobody was going to interrupt me. And they could stop reading, sure, but like my piece could continue and there was nothing they could do about that. So that's why I did it for a while. And then after that, and you know, at that time, that was when the pieces started getting maybe a little bit longer, a little bit more in depth, where I was kind of thinking about, like, I wasn't any longer trying to just demonstrate that I had understood ideas that other people had. I was starting to try to synthesize ideas from other people and put my own ideas kind of on top of it. So that was that phase. And then after a while of doing that, I started writing more longer series. Mostly what I do now is like 3 to 20 part blog series.
20 parts is a really long series.
20
Sorry.
parts is a really long series. Those get tiring, and honestly, they take forever. And I'll like interleave several different series so that I get a break from one while I'm working on another one. But it ended up like what I found was that I would read sources and take these. I would do one of two things. Either I would take this very amorphous topic that people wanted to talk about, but was difficult to like build a framework for, and I would try to come up with a framework to help people think about it. So a lot of the inclusion posts started to be like that. A lot of the posts about leveling up as a software engineer started to try to break down the specific skills that you could use for that. So that's like one variety of posts that I do, one variety of series. And then the other variety of series that I tend to do is series that document my own learning about something. So there's kind of two of those going on right now. One of them is the RAF distributed consensus algorithm, because I think there's relatively little technically detailed but plain English explanations of that out there. They're all either really technically detailed and kind of academic speak, or they like talk about it in plain English, but it like generalizes to the point where people don't understand the technical specifics of the algorithm are not in there.
Right.
And so I wanted to find a way to include the technical specifics but talk about it in a conversational way. And I'll do that. Or the other series that's going on right now is there's this document by Timo Okun and Kenneth Jones about the 13 elements of white supremacy culture. And I'm going through that and doing a piece for each element about like, where do I see this show up in tech? What if impact does that have on our industry? And what might the alternatives be? How could we imagine an alternative to this that might end up making all of us, might end up making tech like a happier, better place kind of for everybody, you know? And in those cases, it's less about me building a framework for it to help other people think about things and more trying to think through those things myself and document that process. And sometimes the real benefit there is like with Raft, like I told you, I put it down for about 3 or 4 months and then I picked it back up. I think it would have been really hard to pick back up, except that I could read back through my blog post and remember, like, oh yeah, that's why I implemented that way. That's what that variable does. So, which is great when you name your variables things like the word array. You need to have documentation of what that
This like thing of trying to backpedal and figure out what all of your like stuff from 3 months ago means is it's difficult.
Yeah. How about you? I'm interested to hear your like reasons for writing. What do you get out of blogging?
Yeah, this is a really good this is a really, really, really good question, and something that I hadn't thought about explicitly until I read a post by Julia Evans, which I think I sent to you as well, and which we should definitely include all of these with this video as
Yeah,
well.
for
Like,
sure.
here is further reading from a lot of smart people.
Yeah.
Something, so yeah, there's been a few things. For me, it started out as like boredom when I was in university lectures, I think. At some point, I really enjoy writing, so that's a part of it. I think part of it is that I like the idea of having a place for thoughts online that isn't controlled by like an external entity. So a little bit of the like indie web sort of thing, like let's keep that alive, please.
Yeah.
And then I think also part of it is because there's a lot of things that like, there are a lot of things that kind of haven't really been documented. Like it's kind of, if I'm looking for a problem and then can't find an answer to it, then I think maybe someone else will need this answer at some point as well. And like the amount of effort that that requires can be anything from like, I wrote something once that I think took like 2 hours. Basically the screws on the bottom of my camera had fallen out while I was like taking some photos. And right. So I found out where I could get new screws from and sourced them, and then wrote a thing about like, hey, if the screws happen to fall out of your like Fuji camera, like this is something you can do. And just so it's there in like a nice concise reference for other people.
Oh yeah.
And then like other bigger projects have been like, okay, I have this really complicated engineering problem. How do I understand this and break this down? And then maybe like give people tools to figure that out themselves as well.
Yeah.
So it's kind of been a combination of things for me. A new reason for writing that I've only just discovered in the last little while is that sometimes people contact you about things that you've written and say like, hey, I really like this. Let's have a conversation. And that like happened to me like 2 days ago and it feels amazing.
It does.
Yeah. But also like you get to have conversations with interesting people sometimes. And so I think this is also like a motivating factor. I definitely relate to this thing about employability as well. I think this is still true even as I've become like more confident as a software engineer and feel like I'm probably like, yeah, as I become more confident, I still think this is useful. But what it tends to be is like, if I'm writing a cover letter to a small, like especially to a smaller company that is maybe like 4 or 5 engineers, and the person hiring is probably someone who I'll be working, like the person reviewing the application is someone I would be working with, then I can link to stuff from my blog, from the cover letter, and say like, well, if you want to know how I work, like, or how I think, then like, here is like some stuff that I've written about how I work and how I think. And like, here is an example of some like cultural activism I did in like one job, but here is an example of my communication style. And that is, I don't know if this is useful or not, honestly. I haven't had anyone explicitly mention this in a job application, but like it certainly helps to develop these thoughts, which is also helpful for interview questions, I guess.
I agree. And I actually think that, the writing that I do is much more illustrative of my communication and technical skills than I think it is much better at communicating those two skill sets than a resume is, because I look at my resume and I see like what companies were on it and what I did there. And I think about colleagues that I had in each of those places. And it occurs to me that like, for those people, this section of the resume is exactly the same as mine, and what they did there, what they got out of that experience was completely different than what I did.
Yeah.
And so how can you, like, there are positions that would be a perfect fit for them and a terrible fit for me, or a perfect fit for me and a terrible fit for them. And our resumes are, as far as a hiring manager knows what they're looking at on a resume, they're the same. They're going to look equivalent. But that's not the case with, like, if that person were to write about how they solve a certain problem and I were to write about how I solve a certain problem, it would become much clearer, like, these are the ways in which these two people are different and enjoy solving different problems or solve problems different ways. And I think that that is much more effective at helping people determine, or helping a hiring manager determine, like, okay, I have a gap in my organization that's shaped like this, and this blog post tells me that Chelsea is shaped like whether she's shaped like that or whether her colleague is more shaped like that, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point that I hadn't thought about, actually. There's someone else whose writing I really, really love, is named Charity Majors, and I think she's like also like quite a well-known blogger, but she wrote a thing about like reasons why we might not hire someone at her company, honeycomb.io. And I think there's like something in there that talks specifically about this idea of like looking to complement skill sets on teams. And like, yeah, I don't know. I think it's a really interesting idea and not something that probably, it's hard to gauge how often this gets thought about in hiring decisions. I think I'm trying to think if like I've thought about this when I've been hiring people before, which probably is more of a reflection on like how polished I, like how good a job I'd done of like the hiring process. But yeah, I think it's an important angle. And yeah, you're right. This is a great way of communicating that. Yeah. That was a very long way of agreeing with you. Sorry.
No, I appreciate it. Yeah. The trouble, of course, is like if the piece is long, then I feel bad. I'm like, oh, well, I don't want the hiring manager to have to spend 9 minutes. Because that's what they tell you with a resume. Like, make it so that they can scan it in 15 seconds. And I'm like, okay, I could do that. They're going to get no information, but okay. Whereas with like with a piece, it's like, well, it's going to take 9 minutes. You'll find out a lot more, but it's going to take 9 minutes.
Yeah, I don't know what the right balance is there, honestly. I feel like that's touching on a different, like on a separate and related problem, which is definitely like, yeah, the whole hiring thing is an entirely different can of, well, not a different can of worms. It's a related can of worms. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. It's strange. So teaching in a graduate program, we talk all the time about interview shape. Like, are you in interview shape? Right. And that's completely different than being in like actually doing your job shape.
Yeah, they're very different skills. Yep,
right?
Definitely.
Which, yeah. Why should it be that way? Why would it be that way? It seems like it's something that maybe we need to address, that like it's completely like the way that I get a job is completely different than the way that I do that job. I think companies are coming around and like kind of trying to fix that, but I don't know.
I had a good interview experience at a company recently that I think had done a really good job of this, but even despite the fact that this was very intentionally designed to be like this, there were still some things that were different. Like there was a debugging example or like a debugging exercise in this, which I'd never seen in an interview before. And I thought was really cool. But even that, which is designed, it was chosen because it simulates like what happens in actual work, you know, like a lot more effectively. That even that is different to what it would be like if I'd been working at a company for 6 months and was debugging. And I think like the way that I approached this problem like also reflected that, because my first thought was like, okay, I'm just going to like read the code and figure out what's going on. Because in my last job, I could have done that because I was familiar enough with the code base that I was working on that would work. But I had no idea where to start with this. And then the interviewer eventually said, like, maybe use the stack trace and like figure out from there where it's going. And I was like, oh yeah, this is something that just didn't even occur to me because I'd been developing from like the other perspective for so long. And I think it's interesting because even when there are some things that are just fundamentally limitations of the interview process, and then the thing that patches it over is interviewers providing suggestions and being compassionate like that, I think.
It's funny that you mentioned that because So I write on an open source application. It's an open source dual platform application. It's on React Native, and I am in the process right now of trying to figure out how to build an open source community around that app. And I was talking to the client about that the other day and expressing this goal that has to do with the way that the software is documented and how much people need to know about the software in order to contribute to it. I think one of the things that you're speaking to with this interview experience is that the debugging process is a little different when you are familiar with the code versus when you are not familiar with the code. And
yep.
So in addition to testing debugging, they're effectively testing your skills at like forensic software analysis. And so
maybe
what
that
I was
intentional
saying to my colleague was, what'd you say?
Maybe that was part of the plan or the intention. Like at a sufficiently large company that might make sense. It could be intentional.
Yeah. You would need to be able to do that in order to be able to get familiar with the legacy code base. But yeah, and I was talking to my colleague and I basically said, you know, I want it to be possible for relatively junior folks to contribute to the application. Maybe not relatively junior in the sense that like this is their first time ever working on JavaScript, but I do not want forensic software analysis to be a required skill to be able to contribute to this app, you know? Because that takes time, and it also takes a very specific set of experiences maintaining legacy applications. If you've only written Greenfield apps in your career, you don't necessarily have that.
Right. Yeah, there's a piece here as well about, like, I think this is like a good thing to think about generally in terms of there. Oh, I didn't really know where I'm going with this yet.
Okay. We're talking. We'll get there.
Yeah. This is definitely like a quarter baked idea. I think there are a lot of open source projects that have steep learning curves. Projects in general. And I think building software that is easy to contribute to is it's a skill and it's a hard one. And it's interesting seeing different projects try and take, like, have an approach to that. I think, like, there's probably a part of it, like, this is definitely, like, well outside of my range of expertise, and so maybe I should stop talking about it soon, but, like, I think, like, I've really noticed that, like, the Rust community and, like, a lot of projects in the Rust language are really, really welcoming, which also they kind of need because the language has, like, a huge surface area and it's quite hard to pick up. Mm-hmm. And like, I know that there are other projects that have typically been like open source, like larger open source projects that are also like a little more, like they're more difficult to pick up. They're like harder to submit patches to because the process is more complicated. It's harder to do testing. Like there is definitely a thing about like streamlining your contribution process and making it accessible to people, but it requires a lot of effort and a lot of energy. And so it ultimately becomes a prioritization question, I guess. Absolutely. I'm not sure.
I think that maintaining an open source project is like a full-time job on top of contributing to, like, if you're a full-time contributor to an open source project and your job is to write code on it, it would be difficult, I think, to write a lot of code to the project and also maintain the open source community and maintain the open source approachability of the project.
I mean, even just like there have been times in my career where I've been simultaneously a manager and an individual contributor and like only managing a team of three. But even that was like, that's a hard balance. I don't know how you get, like, it's hard to do focused technical contributions when you're also managing people, and I can't imagine that that's easier. It has to be harder on an open source project where you also don't automatically have the rapport from working with the same people like all the time.
How did you end up splitting your time between individual contribution and managing?
I don't know. I was not as intentional about this as I would have liked to have been, I think. It was really helpful because all of my reports were, again, like my company was set up so that I was the only person working on this time zone. So I had those mornings and those afternoon periods where like afternoons would be more focused on like mentoring and management stuff, and then mornings would be more focused on individual contribution. But inevitably, like, there's stuff that like spills over in both directions.
Right.
And I was super lucky in that my team was like absolutely fantastic. So it was really easy. But yeah, I don't know. I sort of found that over time, my contributions were becoming less, like, the technical complexity of the work that I was able to take on just kind of, if I tried to do anything hard, it would stall because of that split focus. And like, I think time boxing and stuff is like a strategy for this, so like explicitly deciding that in the morning you're going to do this and in the afternoon you're going to do this. But ultimately, like, to do sustained complicated hard technical work, I think you need freedom to like just be able to hide away and like just do that for a while and then emerge at the end and then explain it to everyone. But yeah. But yeah, that's a complicated topic.
It's a tough balance to strike for sure.
Something I wanted to ask about back to blogging. Maybe we're coming around in a bit of a circle here, because this is kind of touching on the fact that like technical work is not strictly, it's not always just about programming, right? Like programming jobs are also like people jobs. And you were saying that you are writing a series at the moment, talking about the 13 kinds of white privilege. Was that correct?
Yeah, the 13 elements of white supremacy culture.
The 13 elements of white supremacy culture. So this is a very obvious place in which like there is an intersection between technical work and social and like the social and cultural issues that like exist in the environment that we perform this work in. Can you like talk a little bit about how you approach like pulling all this together, like this kind of intersectionality? I don't know if this is the right way to even ask these questions, but I would really love perfect. To hear about this. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's an interesting one because the way that I like once upon a time when I was a baby programmer, I guess, it was very important to me that my blog posts stay solely on the technical as much as possible, because I was concerned that people would pigeonhole me as not a technical contributor if they saw like culture related posts on my blog. And I think either with more experience, I became less concerned about that because the technical posts are like pretty technical, or I just kind of stopped caring. I'm not sure which of those it ended up being, but the truth is that I think that the skills that make us good programmers are also helpful in understanding the social and ethical aspects of our jobs if we are willing to apply those skills rather than skirt around those topics. Because as programmers, our fundamental responsibility is to build a model of an interaction, of a marketplace, of relationships. We take these amorphous concepts that have existed sort of in society in the past, and we want to build a model of them that is accurate enough that our product is useful and flexible enough that if our product's not useful, we can iterate on the model to make the product useful. And I think that as software engineers, we hear a lot of discourse about how, oh, worrying about ethics isn't my job, worrying about culture isn't my job, worrying about the technology is my job. Well, the skills that we develop to worry about the technology are also applicable to these larger questions that we have if we're willing to step into that and step into the discomfort of that rather than step away from it. It's uncomfortable sometimes to talk about, let's say, like racism in the tech industry, white supremacy in the tech industry, but if we're willing to sit with that discomfort and we step into that place, I think we'll find that a lot of the skill sets that we use to write good code are also useful for helping us figure out how to understand these types of things. And so a lot of times what I find myself doing is attempting to take something like how like the tech industry is really struggling right now with what an inclusive company culture is supposed to look like, you know? The way that we see companies solve their hiring problems a lot of times is with money. And I want to be careful about naming names of tech companies on a recorded call.
Yep, I've been doing that too.
But that having been said, we see Silicon Valley companies and they get a reputation for being unethical places. They have some scandal happen. They get a reputation for being bad about data privacy, bad about inclusion, bad about crossing picket lines, or now I'm getting sort of right up to how specific I'm prepared to be.
Yep.
And the way that they solve those problems, like we don't necessarily see an effort on their part to solve those problems from the inside out, or maybe there is one, but it's not particularly effective. The way that we see from the outside that they're solving those problems is they just pay more. They just put a higher ticket on engineering there, because they understand that there's social hazard associated with engineers going there now. And they essentially throw money at the problem rather than solve the problem. And we don't have useful, systemic, well-understood tools in tech for addressing deep-seated issues like that other than, like, the main one we see used is pay people more, and we don't see other ones kind of used. And the tools that we see developed are extremely rudimentary. An example being a quota. a company will get in trouble for being not an inclusive place. And what do? They like institute a quota on how many of different kinds of people they're going to hire, how many they're going to interview, and all these types of things. And like a quota is once again a pretty rudimentary tool that doesn't necessarily get at the core issue of like, why isn't your workplace why is your workplace only attractive to a certain demographic of people? Like, why is only a homogeneous group interested? Why aren't you appealing to a wider group of potential perspectives? So with a lot of those series, I think what I'm attempting to do is take that set of skills that we use to solve problems and model processes as software engineers and apply them to something adjacent to software but still very intertwined with software, which is the relationships that we build as software engineers with our community and with our industry, with our bosses, with our colleagues, with designers, with product managers. And I find that although the topic feels different from the technical topics that I'm working on in like the Raft series, for example, the problem solving is relatively similar, where I'm identifying the points of friction where our current model isn't working, trying to figure out what the systemic causes of that might be, and knowing that there's usually not one cause, there's usually like a series of things that went wrong one after the other. Like, what are all of them? How do we figure out how to fix, like, at what point are we prepared to stop trying to lay the blame at someone's doorstep and instead figure out all the different ways in which our system could be contributing to a better outcome? And they're satisfying posts to write, although they're satisfying posts. No, they're not satisfying posts to write. They are satisfying to work on, but I am very rarely satisfied with the outcome. So this is something I think I'm still working on.
Can you explain why you are less satisfied with the outcome?
Yeah, I think that because I have more practice applying this skill set to software, it's more common, although not always, that I am satisfied that I have come up with a model in software that is accurate enough for now and flexible enough to iterate on later. Whereas with some of these other things, I'm not satisfied with the accuracy of the model, and I'm not always satisfied either with the clarity with which I expressed it. So a good example is in this 13 Elements of White Supremacy Culture series. Sometimes I get to the end of a blog post and I'm like, I don't know what the alternative would be here. I'm very much, you know, as a white lady, I just don't possess the background to imagine the alternatives all of the time.
Right.
And so I end it with basically a question mark of like, man, I hope we find a way to fix this, you know, but I don't know what it is. And in those situations, I certainly feel inadequate. And I have to remember that it's not up to me by myself in this one blog post to fix white supremacy in tech culture. Like, that's a fundamentally white supremacist idea that it's on you right now to fix this immediately. Like, I'm part of a wider group of people that hopefully will fix this over generations, and it's going to take time, and I don't have to have all the answers. But it's, you know, I think we're all very good at being hard on ourselves and wanting to have the answers, especially when we're putting it in writing. I did have a question for you about kind of like your writing process, zooming down to like an individual blog post as opposed to blogging in general. I'm interested to know like how you get from like an amorphous idea to then having something to publish.
That is a lot easier than the last question. So I've been thinking about this a little bit. Sometimes it's a thing where there was something that like someone asked me at work and I didn't have an answer, and we tried to figure it out together and we still didn't have an answer. And so I would start writing based on that. The problem is you always start, like, my ideas are always super nebulous, and you can probably see this in the way that I'm talking as well. My brain is like, da, 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 da. It's kind of like floating around. I'm bad at sticking to things and following them through. I talk to people who can like start a blog post and then an hour later it's done, and they've just like followed a consistent thread the whole way through in their brain, and mine just doesn't work like that. Mm-hmm. So what I find myself doing a lot of the time is starting with some idea and then writing the thing and then realizing that I've somewhere along the line pivoted into like a different topic, and then saying like, wait, hang on, and then extracting that and making a blog post for that instead. And so this is like, I wrote something today. I think it's the fastest I've ever written a blog post ever. It took like 3.5 hours. and it's like, I set out to write something about how do you get unstuck when you're debugging something, because I thought this would be easy because it's something that I've been debugging stuff for like 8 years now. Maybe I already know how to do this. Maybe I can just like write this up easily, and then found myself writing up a thing about how to explain a problem, or like how to ask for help, how to write down exactly the problem that you're experiencing and be precise and like add redundancy to your questions so that like to minimize chances of miscommunication if you're asking for help from someone online. And so in the end, I thought, actually, this is a useful thing, and just like took that out and then put it in a new thing, and then kept writing that. So for me, it's been about following those threads and then just like finding one that I can latch onto for long enough to like actually finish it and hit the publish button. This is also true for the bigger ones too. Like sometimes the bigger ones turn out to be like, I end up just like writing like crazy for a day or two and then spending the next like few days cutting. And this is like, I'm talking this, the one I have in mind was like a 3,000 word essay when it was finished. So it was like 5,000 words to start with, and then just like cutting bits back. And like, as I refine my understanding, realizing I could drop bits. But yeah, so for me, it varies wildly based on the content. But usually it's about like kind of just writing and then like taking a bit and then like saying, yeah, this is a thing. This has legs, this idea. Is your process similar or like entirely different, or?
It depends on the piece. Sometimes I do it in one sitting, and sometimes it takes me multiple sittings. Lately, things take me multiple sittings. I think in part because now, like I said, rather than doing one-off posts, I tend to do larger series. And I like to take some time to consider the structure of the series, usually figure out how things are going to layer in on top of each other.
I wanted to ask about this, so I'm glad you...
What'd you say?
No, I said I wanted to ask about this, so I'm glad you're answering it, and then cut off the other half of your answer. Can you say that again?
Yeah. Is that, you know, I want to figure out how everything's supposed to layer in, and I don't make outlines. I probably should. I just sort of like keep the outline in my head, and I think I have this picture in my mind of the way the series is going to look, and I try to write it post by post, but a lot of times what ends up happening is I'll try to write one post in the series, and similar to you, I'll realize it's getting long and I'll try to figure out how to split it out. Even so, the other day, this happened to me for the very first time the other day, I was writing a piece, and what I realized was that it was the second post that I had written on a topic, but I realized it was actually the third item in a series, and the first post had covered two items. And that first post was also extremely long. It was more than 2,000 words. I try to keep posts under 2,000 words if I can.
Okay. Is there a reason for that limit?
Basically just people's attention span. I've realized that if I write a 5,000 word post, like even people who absolutely love me and are my best friend just can't, it's a lot, you know? And so I'll try to like keep things relatively limited. And I do think it's funny when courses advertise like 700 hours of video, like so many words of text. And I'm just like, why is it going to take you 700 hours to teach me this? I don't have that time. So I try to like limit the amount of time that I'm asking of people to provide something useful. But in that case, what I ended up doing was going back to the post I'd already published and splitting it up and publishing a second one and then backdating it so that I could then publish the third one like a while after the second one was published, which I don't usually do. And it was probably very confusing to my... So I don't have a button on my blog for like subscribing for post updates. I used to. Though I just didn't think, instead I have like I have a drip thing that comes up from the bottom. It says, can I write to you? And I'll send people roll-ups of series when I finished a series, so you don't get updates as often.
Okay.
But back in the beginning, I think the blog like came with a button that allowed people to subscribe for every post, and like there are people still on it, and so I think it was a confusing day for them because they got a new post that was stuff they had already seen, And then when they clicked on it, it said that it had been published a month ago. And then later that same day, they got another new post email, and that one was actually for the correct day and had new information and everything. So, yeah.
I think people are pretty forgiving of stuff like this generally as well. I did want to follow that thread about like audiences, though, like about like emailing people about it. Like, how do you, I think there's a question. So this is definitely a question for me when I started blogging, and it's still a little bit of a question. How do you go about, like, what do you do to ensure that your work is seen by people? Something that I have taken to doing for this, which is a little bit shameless. I'm not really on Facebook anymore. And that's like where most of my network was. So what I'm doing instead is just writing something and then literally WhatsApping the link to some of my friends. It doesn't work as well with like programming posts, but this has been great because then it's a personal message. So your friends kind of engage with it a little more. It's not just like, scrolling while on the train, or maybe I'll read this. It's like the reach is like way less limited, but the quality of those interactions is like really satisfying because a friend of mine has now read this thing and been like, oh, this is cool. Or like, okay, thanks. Maybe they're getting sick of it by now. I don't know. But like, what's your strategy in terms of like people reading stuff that you've written?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I'll be upfront, I'm not good at this. I like don't have a great strategy. What I do is I have a couple of Slacks where I'll like post it, or sometimes, not all the time, I'll put a post on Twitter when I have a new post, or if I have spoken with someone prior to having written the piece about writing a piece on that topic, I'll send it to that person specifically and be like, look, I wrote it up. But I haven't, and this is to my detriment, I just haven't prioritized really increasing the reach of the audience of the blog. And as a result, sometimes I'll actually get messages from people where they're angry, where they're like, why didn't you tell me that you were writing
this? That's amazing.
But definitely I have very much focused on like, I'm writing these things for me to try to figure out what I think, to try to build a framework that, you know, and I think that my focus has always been sort of like selfishly, what am I getting out of writing this piece? And then once I've written the piece, I've gotten the thing out of it that I wanted to get out of writing the piece. And I'm not really worried about whether other people see it or whatever, but I should be better about that. And I'm not. So that's an area of improvement for me. So I appreciate your idea about sending it to like specific friends. I have to think about whether I would have like a small group of colleagues who would be interested maybe in specific posts or something. I could probably be more deliberate about that than I am, for sure.
Like, for me, this is just 100% fulfilling my need for social validation. It's not like a brilliant strategy. It's just like, there's nothing search engine optimizey or like this is not marketing. This is just but I think this touches on motivation as well. Like, what you're describing here sounds to me like the thing that motivates you to do this is like the thing that you get out of it yourself. Like, it sounds like you're like intrinsically motivated with your blogging, whereas and like, I think that's also true for me, but it's also true for me that like, I get like a little bit of a high, like when I find out that my friends have read it. I don't know about analytics. I don't know if this is a good idea or not. I have them. They're extremely minimal. It's not like I can't break down by like all these categories and stuff. I think if it was anything more intense, it would probably be unhealthy. Mm. But it's nice to have that feedback loop of knowing that people read your stuff for me.
Looked at it. Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm similar. So I host my blog on WordPress, and the nice thing about that is that they were handling SEO for my pieces like long before I knew anything about any of that.
I still didn't know anything about SEO.
Me either. I'm just like, all right, well, I'm gonna write this thing. Like, there's probably no point in Google indexing part 6 of my RAF distributed consensus algorithms here. Who's gonna read that? You know, people who are invested in learning about Raft already will read that, which is the guy who taught it to me and like the 7 people who I took the class with or whatever.
Like, right.
This is not interesting to a broad audience for sure, but that's one nice thing about it. It does have some analytics with regard to how many people have viewed each post recently and how many people have been on the blog today. And it's this little bar chart. It used to feature prominently on the dashboard. It doesn't anymore. And so as a result, I
Interesting.
don't really even look at it. But back when it did feature prominently on the dashboard, I would see like, oh, the bars are here, 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 here. And then sometimes I would come on the blog one morning and like all of them are down here
And it's
and one
like,
of them's up here.
yeah.
And I was just like, oh, what famous person found something and tweeted it or whatever. Somebody put something in an email list or something. And on
That's
those
hilarious.
occasions, I'm usually curious. And so I click on it and I'm like, all right, what blog post did they find? Who did it? Sometimes I could find who did it, sometimes I can't. But I can usually figure out what post it was.
Yeah.
But for a long time, the one that was making the rounds was how to write automated tests for recycler views in Android.
Oh, cool. I didn't even know
Yeah.
you could write automated tests for like UI testing on Android is still a mystery to me, even after having worked on Android.
Well, one thing I will say is that Android is the second most difficult framework that I have experienced for installing automated tests at the level that I want them, the hardest being iOS. Like Android, I have found it easier than iOS, but it's like the two mobile frameworks are here in terms of like they're up at a difficulty level that's just like way beyond servers and that kind of thing. And I think there's some reasons for that that make good sense. Like there's so much that a mobile app needs to be able to handle for the user that like I understand the engineering reasons why we inherit from classes provided to us by Android and iOS. But that tall hierarchy of inheritance does present challenges with regard to testing. And the number of just like static methods that are used, singleton stuff that's used, and it's just like without the people who wrote the framework investing an equal or greater amount of time in putting together like test environments for it, it's just really hard to do. Even dependency injection. How do you inject a dependency into an activity that you're not responsible for instantiating? Like the framework does it. So how do I have any control over what gets injected if the framework does
Oh, this is bringing back memories.
it? It's
Yeah.
tough. And Android,
Oh.
luckily we have like some tools on Android, particularly Robolectric has been such a, it has saved me on so many occasions. But even shadow activities, like if you get too in the mix with a shadow activity, it reminds you real quick, I'm just a shadow. I don't do the things that
Yep.
the actual activity does. And the number of times where I've been like I time boxed the effort and I got more and more frustrated and I was like, forget it, I'm making a spy of the real activity and I'm gonna check stuff on the spy.
Great.
That happens too. But
Yeah, I mean, like you have to do what you have to do, you know.
yeah.
Ultimately, like testing is a pragmatic thing rather than like there's no point in being super purist about it, I don't
Oh
think.
yeah, you gotta fight a little dirty sometimes. That's
Yeah.
in
Like all the time with Android
there.
development.
That's absolutely true. Oh my God.
Oh.